This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name's Jordan Fennell. Coming up on the show, press freedom is under threat after staff at the Solomon Islands Broadcasting Corporation have been instructed not to run anti-government stories. Also, new research shows the pandemic has left dozens of pregnant Pacific seasonal workers stuck in Australia and New Zealand with costly medical bills.
When seasonal workers come, I think New Zealand and Australia kind of dehumanise the person as the worker. You know, they're not meant to have sex when they come here, but they do. But the pandemic, people really took solace with each other. So we're going to have to be seeing more of these COVID babies like we have in the last year or two.
You'll hear more on that story in about half an hour's time. And a Fijian man has gone super viral on TikTok for turning household items into high fashion. Shahil Prasad's story coming up in about 40 minutes. But first, an Australian government body has accepted a formal complaint opposing a massive proposed copper and gold mine in PNG. The Frida River Mine Project, run by the Australian-based Chinese-owned Pan Ost, plans to build a large open-pit mine and hydroelectric dam. But thousands of locals who fear long-lasting harm to their river system are fighting the more than 16,000-hectare project. Adam Jacobson has a story.
The complaint alleges Pan Ost failed to uphold Indigenous communities' right to free and informed consent around the project and a proposed tailings dam. It's being filed by not-for-profits Project CPIC and Jubilee Australia Research Centre to the Australian National Contact Point, or NCP, and comes on behalf of more than 2,500 Indigenous people from over 60 villages. Project CPIC coordinator Manu Penny says he wants Pan Ost held to account for its failure to properly speak to locals.
What we want as an outcome is for them to come back to each villages, but an independent body must be the one to do the awareness.
The NCP is part of the Australian Department of Treasury and is responsible for dealing with OECD regulations around Australian-based multinational companies. Jubilee Australia Research Centre Executive Director Luke Fletcher says while the NCP can't hold Pan Ost legally accountable, it can bring disputing parties together to hash out their concerns.
The NCP will endeavour to come up with a negotiated settlement. If the settlement is not possible, that is to say if the parties are unable to come to an agreement, then they will issue a final statement on the matter. So it doesn't have the binding force of law. So the company is not, there's no sanctions it can apply, which is, I guess, one of the criticisms that we've had of the process. But at present, the Australian NCP doesn't have that power. It's still important nonetheless because it brings attention to the issue.
The 125 square kilometre tailings dam needs to safely hold billions of tonnes of mining waste far into the future. But a review of Pan Ost's environmental impact statement found it downplayed risks from dam ruptures and didn't mention plans to maintain the structure forever. Michael Main is one of the 10 independent experts who reviewed their statement.
That was the real red flag for me when I was like, well, obviously this is being constructed over the Pacific River Basin and there's no point in time where it can be allowed to fail.
The report prompted United Nations experts to write to the governments of PNG, Australia, China and Canada. In their letters, 10 special rapporteurs said the mine disregarded human rights and undermined the rights of CPIC children to life and a healthy environment, including the rights of unborn generations. Mr. Main says if the dam bursts, it would be catastrophic.
Well, it's an extreme consequence dam. It threatens people's lives. It would destroy one of the largest and most pristine river systems in the world, but also the people who are living along it.
Mr. Fletcher says local communities have taken issue with almost everything about the mine project.
There's been a lack of transparency. There's concern about the safety of the tailings facility. There's just the general environmental footprint of the project is huge, and this is a very remote part of the world.
Legal action has also been threatened, with the governor of East Sepik Province saying the provincial government will go to court if the mine is approved. Mr. Penny says challenging the mine is not just about protecting local communities, but preserving the river and forests for future generations.
When we're fighting for the Sepik River here, we're not just fighting for our river and our home. This is an iconic river in the Pacific, so it's our pride in the Pacific. And one of the last remaining pristine, biologically diverse place in the world.
Pan Aust was approached for comment, but failed to respond.
Reporter Adam Jacobson with that story. The COVID-19 global pandemic shut down international borders and limited travel between Pacific countries. But for criminal networks, the pandemic actually provided the perfect cover for illegal activity and the trade in illicit substances. And as borders across the Pacific reopen, heads of police and security officials are meeting in Fiji to discuss how to crack down on international criminal activity. Joining me now is Samoa's Deputy Police Commissioner Papali'i Monalisa Tiaikini, who is also the chair of the Pacific Transnational Crime Network. Talofa.
Talofa, Jordan.
Lovely to have you on the show. Deputy Commissioner, can you explain for myself and the audience what sort of criminal activity you saw rise in Samoa and transnationally across the Pacific as well during the pandemic?
Thank you. I think during the pandemic, some of Transnational Crime Network assessment. We saw that there was opportunity by criminal groups to continue trafficking drugs around the Pacific region. There was a spike in terms of reporting vessels of interest from across the TCUs across the Pacific region. So, with vessels of interest, there's always indications that there are transnational crime activities going on. But particularly, we have seen the detection of drugs in New Zealand, Australia, and, some of the few countries in Fiji as well. So that's a clear indication that, these criminal groups were still using the pandemic as an opportunity to traffic their drugs around the Pacific region, especially to the market in Australia and New Zealand.
We know, of course, that, the Pacific can often be used sort of as a drug route for traffickers to travel through and bring drugs to Australia and New Zealand. But I'm wondering what sort of impact is that having on communities in the Pacific specifically and in Samoa? Are you seeing a rise in drug use in Samoa or an impact on families and communities?
Yes. Initially, when PTCN was put together back in 2002, we saw that that the Pacific was actually being used as a transiting point. But we are now seeing that even our communities are affected by it. There's a growing number of methamphetamine and cocaine being detected. Not only in Samoa, but across the Pacific. So we are seeing that, whilst the market is still Australia and New Zealand, there has been use of drugs across our Pacific region. And that's a really concern for us. It's the impact on our communities, especially our young people.
And at these meetings with the other heads of police and police officials from around the Pacific in Fiji, what exactly are you hoping to take out of these meetings and what sort of action do you want to see come out of it?
So we're very fortunate with the Australia Pacific Security College bringing us together. This conference is not just heads of police. It's immigration representatives, it's academia. The purpose of this conference is to really discuss how we can strengthen our networking in the Pacific so that, information can be shared, real-time information can be shared, so that our law enforcement are able to respond to all these activities that are going on around the region.
Is there anything in particular, though, that you want to see come out of it, perhaps to the advantage of Samoa? What would help Samoa that would come out of this particular meeting?
I think for Samoa, it's just, talking to other counterparts and affirming their ongoing support, not just for us, but for, CCUs across the region. And also to identify, I think now the opportunities that we are here with researchers and academia who are also in the same room is to discuss ways on how we can, build the capacity of our frontline officers so they can better respond to all these issues.
My guest here this morning is Samoa's Deputy Police Commissioner, Papali'i Monalisa Tiaiketi, also the chair of the Pacific Transnational Crime Network, speaking with me about crime across the Pacific and how police officials are meeting in Fiji to talk about this together and collaborate on this. You mentioned before, Deputy Commissioner, that immigration officials were there as well. And I know the issue of criminal returnees or people who have been convicted of criminal activity and then deported back to their home countries has been a concern. How do you see police dealing with these sorts of cases?
For Samoa, because we are now experiencing the increased number of criminal returnees. We've noted that, these criminal returnees have little or no family support back home because they grew up either in New Zealand, Australia or America. If they don't have, support back home, they'll end up, returning to what they know best. So I think the opportunity here is to look at countries that have already well-established legislations, processes, so that we can take, learn from them and, build our legislations and also our processes so that we can better respond to the criminal returnees issue.
Another issue as well is cybercrime, and one where Pacific Police might not be as well equipped, perhaps, as Australian and New Zealand counterparts to deal with that just because of resourcing. Is that a growing area of concern for Samoa? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's for Samoa, but not only for Samoa, but like I said, it's an issue right across the Pacific. With cybercrime, there needs to be legislation, of course, to really guide us in the enforcement area. And sometimes the lack of legislation impacts on the work that we do. So, we look towards Australia and New Zealand for technical support and also for capability support so that they can help the Pacific in terms of cyber investigation.
And in your collaborations with other police officials and people across the Pacific in terms of this area of cybercrime, do you find that governments are responsive to the police when you're trying to bring about legislation or have those discussions?
Depends on the countries around the Pacific, but I think for Samoa, our government has been very forthcoming in, looking at ways to support us, especially in terms of legislative changes. So I understand that our, Attorney General's Office and Samoa Law Reform Commission are currently now working on Samoa's Cybercrime Act to really support the work that we do as police officers.
And I know that you're also a very strong advocate for women's inclusion in policing. How have you seen that grow, and what is that looking like in the space at the moment?
Oh, I think, opportunities like this, it's also a good opportunity to just myself as a, female officer, networking with other women who are here at this conference. But essentially, the message is to really push for women to, to join the police. It's quite a very exciting field that, also there's still, perception that it should be a male work. But I think I try to use this opportunity, and especially being a deputy commissioner, to sell that message not only to young girls, but to the young female officers who have just joined the police, that there's future in policing for women.
Well, I'm sure, of course, you would be a massive role model for women in Samoa, in particular, seeing you work in that area. Deputy Police Commissioner Papali'i Monalisa Tiaketi, thank you so much for joining me here on Pacific Beat this morning.
Thank you, Jordan. Have a good day.
You as well. That was Samoa's Deputy Police Commissioner speaking with me there. Jordan Fennell with you here on Pacific Beat. And new research is showing that the pandemic left dozens of pregnant Pacific seasonal workers stuck in Australia and New Zealand, and in some cases, leaving the women with highly costly medical bills. That's now prompted calls for those governments to increase support for women seasonal workers. And that research from the Australian National University's Department of Pacific Affairs shows that where previously pregnant seasonal workers would be sent home, because of the border closure between March 2020 and February 2021, 10 women remained in New Zealand. And in a four-month period in 2020, 28 women stayed in Australia. However, pregnancy and birth costs can be up to as much as $7,000 in Australia and $8,000 in New Zealand. Researcher and labour mobility expert Rochelle Lee Bailey told Mackenzie Smith that the expenses often fell directly on the mothers.
It's really not fair. You know, as I said, but usually it's resolved because everyone sends them home and they think that's the end of the problem, which is still not fair. So I think there needs to be something put in place. But I also think, especially during COVID and even now, like where borders are still closed in many Pacific Island countries and only just slowly reopening, there is a duty of care for us to look after these seasonal workers. And I think that includes pregnancies. I mean, not all pregnancies that have occurred in Australia have been before they came. They've also been through sexual abuse. Not all, but there has been sexual violence happening from talking to research participants for their welfare study, and women have become pregnant through that. So I think, you know, it should be on a case-by-case basis to figure out what's going on with that particular worker. And, you know, with COVID, there's been, you know, new relationships that would never, may not have happened. I mean, new relationships do happen when seasonal workers come. I think New Zealand and Australia kind of dehumanise the person as the worker. You know, they're not meant to have sex when they come here, but they do. But the pandemic, people really took solace with each other because there was a lot of wellbeing issues, and, you know, they would, as I said, take solace with each other. And that also, we're going to be seeing more of these COVID babies like we have in the last year or two.
Is the impetus then on governments to provide some sort of support for pregnant women?
Unfortunately, most of the support hasn't come from the government, especially the New Zealand government really came to the party with the Mana Aka Manuhiri program. But like the Australian government didn't come to the party for seasonal workers full stop, even during COVID. They didn't even take into consideration, like we had, what is it, the job seeker and the job keeper. There was nothing for seasonal workers. So I think the onus needs to be on, more on the government to place more support for those kind of issues, which hopefully under the new PALM scheme this may happen. But previous to that, you know, the onus has been on the employers, to be honest. And we've seen a mixed bag of that. We've seen some outstanding employers that have really gone out of their way, paid out of their own pockets and supported workers. And they've had great employers that have known where to find the support system. But I remember at the start of the pandemic when we were having issues with so that was around about April, May, where we were starting to talk about pregnant workers with Kerry McCarthy. You know, people didn't even know where to go to help support their workers. So, yeah, but the onus has been on employers. But, you know, at the end of the day, there's only so much employers can do too. And then, of course, we're only capturing the ones, the pregnant workers that don't just disappear. We've seen quite a few just disappear from the program, so we have no idea on their welfare and wellbeing. So I think, yeah, if we need to look at it, like, in the context right now, the main sources of support with being our employers, the diaspora, local church groups. They've all been involved in assisting.
It sounds like even without the pandemic and border closures, this is still an unresolved issue and maybe still a cruel and unfair treatment just to send home people who get pregnant. Is that a concern for you?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And I think I mentioned that in an older paper that I did just before COVID on the health management of seasonal workers. I think New Zealand and Australia, that is following the standard labour practices from other seasonal worker programs that do just send them home. They don't necessarily give any consideration to or anything that could happen at home, like the shame in going home pregnant and a whole lot of other issues. Though many pregnant workers that I've spoken to have wanted to go home. They are really scared of our systems here because they're unknown.
That was labour mobility expert Rochelle Lee Bailey speaking there. Now it's time to find out all the news from around the headlines around the region this morning. And I'm joined by Carl Evans, who's bringing us everything that's up to date. Carl, how are you going?
I'm well, thanks, Jordan. How are you?
Yeah, really well. Let's start off with some news that there's a Chinese company eyeing off the Solomon Islands deep water port. What more do we know?
Yeah, so a Chinese state-owned company is negotiating to buy a forestry plantation with a deep water port and a World War II airstrip in the Solomon Islands. So that's according to an expose into the deal, which was unearthed on a Four Corners report last night. And that breathes new life into fears that China wants to establish a naval foothold in the South Pacific.
And what kind of evidence for this has actually been uncovered?
Yeah, so according to the report, representatives from the China Forestry Group Corporation visited the plantation that covers most of the Coolumbunga Island in 2019. And they were asking questions about the length of the wharf and the depth of the water and things like that. And the takeover target, which is actually part-owned by Australia and Taiwanese, I believe, they're known as the KFPL, actually wrote to the Australian government warning of strategic threats. It's then understood that the Department of Foreign Affairs then wrote back saying it was not intervening. However, Foreign Minister Penny Wong said Australia is continuing to engage with the KFPL on a potential sale.
Yeah, I'm sure Australia will be watching that very closely, as we've seen recently. A lot of geopolitical tussles happening in the Pacific region, especially with both the US eyes on that area, China's eyes on that area, Australia's eyes on that area. And like you said, that was unearthed on a Four Corners report. That's going to be airing tonight in the Pacific. It's about the extent of the Chinese influence and control on Solomon Islands. And listeners can watch it on ABC Australia at 8 p.m. PNG time tonight. And now talking about, geopolitical tussles, the other story you've got for me is about the U.S. Pacific Commander who is wanting to expand and strengthen its ties with New Zealand.
Yeah, that's right. It all sounds like a bit of a TV show at the moment, doesn't it? But so this message was voiced by the U.S. Pacific Commander, Admiral John Aliquino, during a trip to Wellington. And he wants to expand and strengthen ties with New Zealand, as you said. And it also comes as the US looks to increase its presence in the region amid concerns over China's ambitions. Mr. Aliquino says the leadership of Australia and New Zealand in the Pacific is critically important. And interestingly, this also comes as New Zealand opens its borders for the first time in 2020.
Are there any travel measures that are still in place at all for New Zealand, or is it free rein now for everyone around to come and hang out?
Pretty much free rein. Officials say most visitors will still need to be fully vaccinated, but there are no quarantine requirements, which is great news, and authorities are now accepting visitors and those on student visas again.
Yeah, lovely. They were open, I believe, to Australia and some Pacific countries for a couple of months there, but yeah, I guess now everyone can go and hang out in New Zealand, including the US military, it seems.
Hopefully the slopes are still good.
Yes. And sticking to the topic of the military and the US, there are reports that the US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is going to be visiting Taiwan this evening in a trip that some experts fear could actually trigger a military confrontation with China. How likely is that?
Yeah, well, it sounds pretty crazy. And what's worse is China is actually warning of strong countermeasures if the trip goes ahead. said. So Nancy Pelosi would be the highest profile American politician to visit Taiwan in 25 years, which Beijing views as a gross interference to its sovereignty. However, doesn't own Taiwan, and it's understood the Taiwanese president has invited Pelosi, which has prompted fury in China's state-run media. So China has since ordered military drills, which has alarmed some experts who fear a crisis could develop with the militaries of China, the US and Taiwan all on high alert. So, yeah, pretty scary stuff.
Well, very intense stuff happening. I feel like, yeah, all that news today, it's high intensity. A lot of, military, geopolitics. We'll keep our eyes on it. Carl Evans, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jordan.
Jordan Fennell with you here on Pacific Beat. Now, taking over to Solomon Islands, where the government has ordered the country's national broadcaster to self-censor its news and other programs and only allow content that portrays the nation's government in a positive light. It says it has a duty to protect its citizens from, quote, lies and misinformation, and means the broadcaster will now become a government agency. In May, local journalists boycotted a visit by the Chinese foreign minister after media access was severely restricted. Honiara reporter Dorothy Wickham spoke with the ABC's Beverly O'Connor.
I think for the last year, we've listened to the prime minister complain about the media and not being happy with the way the media was covering the issues of the government. So I don't think it was a surprise to many of us in the media.
Yeah. What is it going to mean, though, for working journalists, this kind of watchful eye?
For me personally, it's a bit concerning because I feel that he doesn't realise the restraints on the media itself and the industry, the fact that we are a struggling industry, very small, and doing this to us is not going to help. And taking control of the national broadcaster is not going to help the situation either. I think there are better ways of sorting this out.
Mm. What has it been like for you in terms of any, sort of censoring up until this point?
Well, we've never had a problem with governments before. That's why I think a lot of people in the media are a little bit concerned about it, because we've always had a lot of freedom in the way we do our news coverage. I don't think this government actually restricts us. I think it's controlling it, their information more than they used to. We were always very free to speak to our ministers, to call them up, request interviews, also very free to get information when we wanted it. Now that's not the case. But I know that is not, that's normal with every government. You have a process. You can't just call up a minister and expect to get an interview. You have to go through, their press secretaries or a media department within a government. That's the normal practice. But for a small town like Honiara, that can actually hinder us, because we're also very small in terms of numbers in our newsrooms too. So that takes a lot of time and waiting, and then you end up with journalists getting a bit impatient.
Yes,
I can. Closer to
I can understand. So, what is your understanding of this process of vetting your work or approving your work?
Well, I don't know about how SIBC is going to do this. A lot of people have asked me that. How do you think this is going to play out? And I'm like, we're not sure, because we haven't seen it happen before. So we're going to have to watch what the government's going to do. Now, if the opposition gets on SIBC and starts criticising government policy, which every opposition does, that's not unusual in a democratic society or in a democratic process. Now, would government disallow SIBC to air that story or that interview? That is the question that we're asking. However, I know officials in government are saying, no, we're not going to do that. SIBC is going to carry on doing what it's supposed to be doing. It'll have a board, it'll have a CEO, a management team, but we want it to be more responsible in the way it writes stories, because it's the national broadcaster. It's not a private company. it is a government-owned entity.
Have there been mistakes made in reporting that has drawn focus on the fact that they want tighter scrutiny?
I think so. I mean, I'm going to be very honest here. I'm not saying they're all bad, but I'm saying that, yes, there have been mistakes. I think in editorial policy, there have not been a lot of control in terms of the way they ensure there's balance. There's the right of reply, at least giving time for somebody else to say something in reply to any allegations or getting clarification from the appropriate authorities. That's happened before here, definitely.
Yeah. So, you know, we've spoken over your reporting and others' reporting once that security pact was signed with China. Do you think this has also been why the government is more focused on the message that's getting across?
I think so. I think government's concerned that the negativity that's being expressed by a lot of Solomon Islanders is affecting how Solomon Islanders look at the way government is trying to roll out its policies, and also the fact that it feels that a lot of the information is not true and it's not balanced, it's not fair and not accurate. And that's why they're not happy with the way the media has been handling, especially the reporting on the China relationship with Solomon Islands.
Yeah. How do your colleagues and yourself feel about your jobs and whether you stay committed to doing the best you can in this environment in the hope that it will ease?
Yeah, I'm hoping. I'm hoping that I, you know, sort of go around with the title of being a senior journalist. So I also have a responsibility to ensure that our younger ones who are coming up in the industry are adhering to ethical standards. And if we lose that, that's when we are brought under such controls or we're criticised. And I know a lot of people in the public actually agree that the media has not been doing its job very well. But I also look at the other side of the picture and say, yeah, hang on, but have you actually helped the media improve? Have you invested in it? Have you put more money into SIBC? Have you raised the salaries so you can get very good editors? And who's doing the selection process? Who's interviewing the staff who are being employed in SIBC? So it's not really SIBC's fault, I think. I think there's a whole lot of reasons why we are at this point with the SIBC issue and also with just the media in general, I think.
Honiara reporter Dorothy Wickham speaking there. Now, a young man from Fiji has achieved global stardom on TikTok after posting videos of himself walking down a catwalk wearing a bench, a water drum and other household goods. Shahil Prasad's fashion show Mini Movies have attracted some 28 million views in countries including the United States and India. Dubravka Volida asked Shahil what inspired him to make the videos, which have become a viral sensation.
I'm actually known for making comedy videos, and there was this thing in my mind which I always wanted to do, even before TikTok started. Like, I have seen a few clips of the fashion runway models wearing absurd things. So I was like, I should try that one day, someday. And there was this trend going on, so I hopped into the trend, and I gave it my own comedic twist. I was like, everyone wears clothes. Let me, like, try something just around my house and start wearing that. And it actually blew up big time, not only on TikTok, but also on other social media platforms like Instagram, Twitter, and also Facebook. So it first blew up in the United States on by TikTok and like Philippines and other countries. And then Dr. Ajaitya, who is from India, actually posted it on Twitter. And then it blew up entirely in India due to Twitter and then Instagram. And then it was being published on India Today, New York Times. It was just all over the article. So, yeah, I never thought it would be like such a big thing.
Wonderful. And can you give us a visual of what it looked like, what you posted, just for those that might not know?
It was just basically me wearing, not clothes, but household items around my household, whether it was a bench, whether it was a water drum, whether it was a tinned roof, and even my sister, for heaven's sake, I also like used her as a prop. You have to see it to believe it. It was basically like wearing props, and which was really tough Like, honestly, I've got cut there due to wearing the tin, due to wearing that drum, the water drum, and the chairs and all. It was heavy. I myself, I can't do more than 3 push-ups. So me lifting all those things was a big deal for me.
Wonderful. And I mean, as you've mentioned, you've had so many followers and it blew up completely on TikTok and other social media. So what sort of impact has it had so far on your life?
At the end of the day, I'm from a country, Fiji Islands. Not a lot of people know about that. It is a small dot in the world map. It's in the South Pacific Ocean. People who drink Fiji water must know where Fiji is, but a lot of people do not know. We are not that big of a country. We are not that advanced. We're just a tropical island. So I'm from a middle-class family and things were pretty basic for me. So I believe through this, I have been getting a lot of opportunities, you know, paid opportunities to be part of endorsements, ads, you know, promotional work. So it has given a good impact on my life.
And in terms of your, I guess, your personal life, what sort of impact did it have on that?
Personal life-wise, well, I've always been single. I'm still am single since the dinosaurs era. So personal life is still being single, but I think professionally it has given me expansion. Personal life still, I have my people there, but not dating or anything like that.
How does it make you feel being, you know, kind of a celebrity?
I wouldn't say celebrity yet. Maybe if I hit 1 million followers, then I could be like, okay, a little bit. But it feels really amazing, especially like when going out, someone from the car, someone from the taxi, someone from the bus ends up screaming my name. Hey, this is the one from TikTok. It's kind of embarrassing. I have to like hide my face. So there's been a lot of attention given and also good attention, great response from people. And it's like really great.
What's next for you?
Hopefully global domination. You never know, maybe. Hopefully some bigger things come through. People have done 16 parts of that trend and people keep asking for more and it keep doing well. So let's see. I think I'll keep doing it until I run out of things in the world. So yeah, do comedic videos. So I don't completely rely on the fashion show videos. I do other types of comedies as well. So yeah, comedy will be definitely a must in bringing a smile to the people's face. That's one of my biggest priorities.
Anything else you would like to add?
Well, to the people who do not know me, I'm from Fiji Islands. So I'm known as Shahil Sherman Flair on all 3 of my social media. If you haven't seen the video, do go check it out. Do leave a follow-up as well. So I would really appreciate it. And I hope to keep entertaining all of you.
That was TikTok video star Shahil Prasad speaking there. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat on this Tuesday morning. Thank you so very much for your company. My name is Jordan Fennell and I will be back at the same time tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time.